I'm Robin, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Robin.
And I was definitely not the woman you would find at a women's meeting, and I wandered into one night, and I met Beth. And what struck me was that she has a way of relating her story in a way that's very accessible, and I connected with that, and she has an amazingly strong sobriety ethic, and I aspire to that, and it's my pleasure to introduce Beth.
I'm Beth, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Beth.
And the reason I'm so relatable is I teach second grade, which is pretty much where my development arrested. So, you know, if you can relate to that, then chances are you might be developmentally an 8 or 9 year old yourself. My sobriety date is December 2nd, 2005. And if you're like me, you can't do the math, so that's 9 years. I just celebrated 9 years of sobriety. You know, gosh, I want to thank Jerry for asking me to be up here. I just told my story a couple of weeks ago, and it's really quite nerve-wracking. You know, I love the podium, and I love being up here, and I'm spent weeks and weeks and weeks, which is kind of what, you know, if you're an alcoholic of the type and variety like me, it's like when you're given carte blanche to think about yourself, I'm like, of course. You know, that and the fourth step, it was just great. So I've been telling my story for like almost 2 months now, and I like, you know, I'll be walking the dog and laughing and being, oh, that's hilarious, and then I'll be like, oh, that's so sad, I can't believe that happened to me. So it's been nice. This is the last engagement that I've gotten that I can actually start to think about other people, and that's what really keeps me sober, is not about me, it's about you all. So sobriety date is December 2nd. It took me about 6 months of being in a sister program to pick up the chip that I hold now. This is not the first time I've been in AA. I came when I was 17, and I knew that there was something very different about the way that I drank. And my story is there are outside issues, and I don't want to offend anybody. I'm also a practicing Catholic, and those two things, you know, on any given day is going to offend somebody, and I don't mean to, certainly, but they both played a prominent role in what helped me to figure out that AA is truly the place that I need to treat my alcoholism, because I tried lots and lots of other places. So I do have to say that I'm wildly comfortable up here, because you guys are mostly men, and that's sort of the way that I drank. You know, I mean, I don't know where the women were, because when I was drinking, it was mostly men, and I would do things like, I played rugby for a while, and I wasn't particularly good at it, but I could drink the way that I needed to in the company of men, and who was going to notice me, you know, and that worked for a long time. So my family history, I don't know that it's relevant or not, but there is alcoholism in my extended family. I have a grandfather that died of alcoholism, and he died before, before I can remember him. And growing up, my parents were very open about that. You know, they would say granddad was this brilliant man who worked for IBM, and they would pay him to go in drunk. And, you know, he would go to AA meetings regularly, pick up his white chip, and then go park the car in the backyard, you know, and he died in the VA hospital. I think of, you know, ultimately what was put on his death certificate was pneumonia, but it was complications due to alcoholism. And my parents would have to, you know, at their age of 26, I think they committed him, you know, to an institution. So that was what I grew up knowing, that alcoholism was tragic. And, you know, what they didn't understand was the disease aspect of it. I think that somewhere in their minds, what they saw was this brilliant man who could just never make the commitment or make the choice to stay sober for long enough to get his life together. And, you know, what I know today reading the big book was that was, I held on to that for a long time and kind of disqualified myself from this program, because I had a job, I had a mortgage, I had all of my teeth, and I felt like that really wasn't what alcoholism looked like, and that's exactly what it looks like, you know, and would have lost all of those things. You know, it's not what keeps me out of the rooms. But so the identification was really difficult, and I'm the only practicing alcoholic in my family, which makes me special, and I like that. You know, I like the distinction. But both of my sisters married alcoholics, and so it is a family in recovery as best we can. We're very tight, and you know, they live close by, so I get to, in sobriety, make up for a lot of the things that I did when I was drinking, and it was a lot of chaos and growing up, I was wildly uncomfortable. You know, I don't know if that's your story. And if it's not, that's fine. You know, just keep sticking around, keep coming back, and eventually you'll hear your story. And that was important for me to know, was that when I came in here, it took me about 6 months to figure out that this was the place for me. And what I knew was that I had taken away the alcohol at that point in my life, and things were not getting better. I was getting progressively more insane and sick, and I had no solution for that. And that's a tough spot to be. And that was where I was very, very early. You know, I would like to say my first drink was four. I was 4 years old, and I drank a bottle of my mother's perfume. Now, most kids, you know, they might stop at the first sip, but I was, like, committed to it. So apparently I drank the bottle and then wobbled out and passed out underneath the coffee table. And, I mean, like, that was a story that they would tell, and they would be like, well, you know, Beth had her first drink at four. And what, you know, I mean, what else goes with that? So it wasn't until I was, like, 13 or 14 that I took my next drink, and it was, like, tremendous self-control to exude, you know, that just the ability of not to drink or commit suicide at that young age. You know, I was a mess. And what it looked like at that age was being very uncomfortable with like lumps in my ponytail. I mean, I would just, my mom would send me off to the bus stop and I would be there and I would feel a lump in my ponytail and that would just set me off and I would pull it out and I would walk myself back down the hill to her and she would be like, what are you doing? I just got rid of you. And I would be like, I'm just uncomfortable. But I didn't have the words. I didn't have the words to express that discomfort. What I knew was that I felt different. I felt upset most of the time because things didn't feel right. And, you know, alcohol was the thing that solved that for me. And it looked, you know, in the beginning, it wasn't always the alcohol. I mean, you know, like when I had that drink at four, I mean, who remembers that? But I remember being in high school and having that next drink and thinking that there's a tremendous amount of power here. And that night, I had tequila. I drove drunk for the first time. I had my first cigarette. And I am like, this is on. You know, this is what it feels like to not be uncomfortable when socks get between my toes. This is what it feels like when I can look out and not feel like I'm less than or not a part of. And that was important for a kid as uncomfortable as I was. We would move around a lot. My dad was AT&T, and so every 4 or 5 years, we would get transferred. So I was always the new kid in school. And I'm, you know, northern, so we came down south, and I had this accent. It was New Jersey, Massachusetts, which isn't, it was like tin to the ears of the southern children that I was around. And that's tough, you know, and so I would not talk a lot, and it was just, you know, it was just god awful. So when I found that drink, and I couldn't drink all of the time, I needed to drink every day, but what I would do instead was cut or be compulsively promiscuous, and those were the solutions before I really could drink like I needed to. And ultimately, you know, what brought me in here was the inability to stop the drinking. The other behavior stopped, you know, and it's too bad. I'm sorry, but I don't do any of that other stuff anymore, and I'm sad to say that with such attractive men here tonight. So, you know, I'm I don't know, 13, 14 years old, and, you know, just desperately in need of a drink, and I knew that by the age of, I think, 15 or something, I'm flunking out of classes already, and my parents are appalled. You know, my mother is a high school English teacher. She was in every school that I was in, and we moved to Hilton Head at this point. You know, this was the final resting home for my school career, and it seemed like there was no middle class. I mean, here, I lived here for a couple of years, there was a bit of a stratification, and you could identify yourself with the cheerleaders, or I was a swimmer and that's what I did, or, you know, there was lots of different groups. And what it felt like where I was going to high school was that everybody did everything all the time. And that meant to me was that I was given carte blanche with the drinking, and I started a lot of drug use at that point. So I'm a sophomore in high school, and my mom is pulling me out of all of the college prep classes because I can't concentrate. You know, I'm drinking too much. I'm doing other things too much. And she's putting me in the remedial classes. And I have an extensive, you're going to notice this, is I've got an extensive vocabulary. I'm very articulate. And I'm thinking to myself, what's a nice girl like me sitting in these classes with these people that are truly not going anywhere? And I mean, it was embarrassing, but at the same point in time, a friend of mine had gone to rehab, and at that point, I think it was Charter by the Sea was the popular, like the rehab du jour, and they were popping up all over the place. And so this kid goes in, and I really liked him. And I thought, well, if he's going to rehab, then chances are there might be something there. And at this point, I had been suspended from high school for smoking pot in the bathroom with the principal's daughter. I mean, it's just stupid, stupid stuff. I was spending a lot of time in ISS, and there was, you know, more Saturdays than not that I was, you know, on detention. So this kid comes back from rehab, and there are like six or seven of us that decide that going to AA would be a good idea. And we're like 16, 17 years old. And so I picked up my first white chip in Hilton Head, South Carolina, very young. And I liked the meetings because we got a lot of attention. You know, being young in AA, you get a lot of attention because what I know today, being an old timer here, or someone significantly with more chronological age, not sobriety certainly, but is that, you know, there's an opportunity to not have to go down that path. You know, the damage that I did spiritually, physically, and psychologically to myself over the next 17 years of active alcoholism is devastating. So to see young people, it's really exciting. It's an exciting thing to see. And I just lapped that up. I loved that attention. And, you know, we'd chain smoke cigarettes and use the F word a lot. And I was just like, this is the best. And, you know, and when I would tell, because I would tell everybody that I was an AA, because I figured that if I did, you guys would kind of relax the standards for me. And that's what happened, you know, and nobody expected me to go to college or do anything. And I was like, this is great. You know, this is not bad at all. And so it was just a battle. You know, my life was a battle, and my parents would try and introduce consequences to kind of motivate me to do things, and they couldn't give me enough consequences to deter what I really wanted to do, which was to change the way that I felt. And one of the ones that they really stuck to was that I wasn't allowed to get a driver's license until I was like old enough to buy my own car and insurance, which was 18, and they were just like, just get C's. I'm in all remedial classes, they're like, get C's. And I'm like, I don't need to drive, you know? I've got, my sister's driving, I don't need a car. That's what I have boyfriends for, you know? And so there was no consequences that they could give me that would stop the progression, truly. So I'm in AA for a little while, and I'm not working with a sponsor. You know, we're all sitting at meetings, and it just feels, you know, fabulous to get the attention that we're getting. And I think that I made it probably about 6 months and graduated from high school and moved away. And I remember thinking when I moved away, thank God I don't have to go to those meetings anymore. You know, I mean, there was a point at which I knew that I would get drunk, and that was really exciting. And that's what I did. I drank and used for the next, I don't know, 17 or so years. I got sober when I was 34. And I can't do that math. Maybe you guys can, but all of that time was really spent trying to control and enjoy the using and drinking. So I would do a series of different things. You know, I kind of hadn't really set myself up for a great future in education or going to college, so I had to do a lot of work around making sure that, you know, I was able to make enough money to go to school, and I had to choose schools that were, you know, pretty crappy, truthfully. And so what I decided to do was to go to Idaho. I don't know why. Idaho was, well, I do know why. His name was Ken, and he was working on a PhD. And I was driving cross country at 18. And you know, my parents are like, this is not the child we raised. They're a very close family. They're very, you know, I don't know. But I was the one that was just like, well, you know, I'm just not going to fit this mold. I'm going to do what I want to do. So I go out there for school, and I remember thinking that if I'm far enough away from them, they're not going to see, because at this point, the drinking really had escalated quite a bit. And I would see them in, like, Blockbuster at home, and that was embarrassing for me, because I'd have to pretend like I was sober, and I was all freaked out, and I'd be like, oh, my God, they know, and they're going to kick me out, and they know. And so I felt like if I took myself far enough away from them that they wouldn't have the debris of my life. You know, I wanted to stay away from them. And that didn't happen, you know, and I was living in Idaho, and you know, it was just a series of step downs. I would leave apartments and places before I would become evicted. And, you know, if I had a check, I would write it. And I had boxes of checks. So I had a lot of stuff. I had a lot of amends to make, too. And eventually, when I left there, it never occurred to me that drinking was a problem. I know that I was doing things that were a little bit more extreme. That's when I started playing rugby. And the reason that I started to play rugby was because they drank. They drank and they act inappropriately. And that was just perfect with me. I needed that because I wasn't able to be a part of, especially the girls. The girls were really intimidating to me. Those women that had the ability to actually get in the first school that they applied to actually go to school, to not get sidetracked and drop out. And God, I remember once being invited to the valedictorian's house for some mother-daughter brunch, and I had nothing to wear. And truthfully, what I felt inside was that I'm not acceptable enough to go into this girl's house because she is upwardly mobile, and I am drinking myself out of high school, and there's no way that those two things are compatible. So I remember just having this glorious Chernobyl meltdown, you know, and just crying and telling my mother that I just couldn't do it. I could not do it. And what a shame that was. I missed out on an opportunity to become friends with and interact with people that would have truly been beneficial to me. But I couldn't because of what I was doing, the way that I was living. So, I don't know, I stay in Idaho for a couple of years. And it's time to move from there because I've burned all of my bridges. And I flunked out of school, I think, the first semester, maybe. And so I decided to move home. And it's a series of, you know, odd jobs, going to community colleges and really just sort of kicking about, not really having a lot of responsibility. And, you know, I wound up taking a job in Switzerland. I was a nanny for 2 years and stopped a lot of the outside issues because I didn't have access to any dealers, truthfully. But what really happened was that I started to drink in earnest. And I remember thinking, you know, because my entire life is spent not being my grandfather because he was a mess. He couldn't choose not to drink. And like, here I am in a foreign country and I'm just going to rock this. I'm going to have a great old time. And I remember in Switzerland on Sundays was when they had the rugby games. And that was a big deal because I'd never really been drunk on a Sunday. And not counting brunches because those don't count, and tailgating, Super Bowl parties. I mean, those are exempt from that sort of thinking, but truly no special occasion, drunk on a Friday or a Sunday afternoon at like 5 or 6 in the evening, there's really no hope to get sober enough to be presentable on Monday morning. And I remember the first time that happened, and I was slobbering, fall down drunk, and I remember thinking that there were certain roadblocks that I'd been putting in my life so that I wasn't an alcoholic. Even then, I knew that there was something different. There was something different about the way that I drank, and I was desperately trying not to drink the way that I needed to. And you know, that night going to bed, and I don't know at what point I passed out, but I was just appalled because, you know, people that have problems drinking are drunk on a Sunday and they can't get sober before they go to work. And then the next morning, I don't think that I was sober when I went to work, but I was able to acclimate pretty quickly. And what I learned was that I could be drunk anywhere that I was and still function enough so that you wouldn't know. And that was pretty important to know, you know, it really was. Because when you're a nanny, they expect you to drive carpool and do very important things with the children that you're caring for. And they frown upon drunk driving at like 8 o'clock in the morning. But if you drank like I did, that's exactly what would happen. And not often, but often enough to know that was not okay. So I did my time in Switzerland and had a great time. You know, I would power drink. They would have these trains that would stop running at like midnight. And I lived far out of the city and I would have to get in and do my business fast. I mean, you had to get in, get out, because I wasn't going to stay until 5 a.m. when the next train went, and it was like 100 francs to get back. So I would have to drink very hard and very quickly, get on the train, and then eventually I'd have to get off a couple of stops early because I'd have to vomit, because that's the way that I drank. And in my world, in the end of my drinking, every time I drank, I vomited for hours. I mean, I just couldn't metabolize it. And that's why I think some of the outside issues were a little bit easier for me to stomach, because I wouldn't have the same reaction. But I, you know, again, it was that trying to be other than and making sure that there were some sort of roadblocks. And, you know, only alcoholics stay out until 5 o'clock in the morning and then take the last train. And I didn't want to do that. So I came home from Switzerland after 2 years and dried out on my parents' sofa for 3 days. And I remember being terrified because they had moved in the interim again, because that's what we did. We always moved, and I was always adapting to a new place. And it was an unfamiliar place. It was Illinois, and who moves to Illinois? And so that's where they were. And of course, I hadn't made any plans at all. So that's where I wound up after my my time in Switzerland ran out. And I remember being terrified because I couldn't drink the way that I had been. I'd been used to it, and it had been an acceptable part of my personality. And all of a sudden, I'm in my parents' basement again. And they don't drink like that. I don't even know that they drink, truthfully. I've never noticed it. But, you know, what happened was that there was a period of time when I was moderately successful. I was able to graduate from college. I, you know, got my life together. I spent a lot of time making those, and I didn't know that they were financial amends at the time. It was cleaning up my credit. And so I got myself to a point where the damage that I'd been doing when I was a little bit younger was mitigated. And, you know, if you had asked me at that point, I always felt when I was drinking that the consequences were never going to catch up to me. And I was positive that I would be dead before I was 30. And it wasn't a hard thought. It wasn't an unpleasant thought. It was just the knowledge that I couldn't live the way that I was living and survive it. There just wasn't any way. And so I'm living in Illinois and I hit 30 and I was so disappointed. And I was like, oh my God, what do you do now? I mean, what happens with life now? And what it looked like was, you know, it's just one of those God moments. Bill talks about it in his story when he's at Winchester Cathedral. He gets that he's much moved. And you know, periodically I would have these moments where God would intervene. And, you know, at that point it was introducing me to a family that I would work for. I worked for them for, I think, 6 years, and they had 4 children. And she was very Catholic. And I became very Catholic, and I would go on Friday nights, and I would spend time at the convent, because I figured at this point that the way I had been living thus far in my life was really because I was bad and immoral, not because I was an alcoholic. It's very different. So I'm trying to treat my alcoholism in the Catholic Church, and that might work for some people. And I remember sitting in the pews and being very arrogant about it, because I figured for sure that that was it. This was the magic bullet, that I was going to get my life on track. I'm hanging out with nuns. Nuns don't drink. Nuns don't smoke. They're not out doing stuff they shouldn't with the boys. I mean, they're just like, let's watch like Matlock on Friday nights. And I'm like, I'm doing it, sisters. I'm with you. You know, keep me sane. Keep me sober. And it just didn't work. And I would sit in the pews at church with absolutely no humility. And I would think, you know, if anybody was going to levitate, like, right now, it should be me, because I'm super holy. You know, I am working this Catholicism thing for all it's worth. And what I was doing in regards to the drinking was I would take these vacations. Like, for 2 weeks, I would go and binge drink, and I would drink from the time I woke up until I passed out. And I was choosing companions that were a little bit less than I was. You know, my friend that had a purse full of pills, and she was great, and the guy over here that, you know, was just a giant mess, and I always felt a little bit superior to them because they drank every day. I didn't. I just did it when we were on vacation very far away from where I lived. But what I noticed with them, even them, was that I was the first one up. I was always the first one up. And what the book tells me is that, I mean, that's me detoxing. That's my body saying, I need more alcohol. I can't make it. I can't sleep through the night because I need to get drunk well before then. And, you know, I would be like, hey, who's ready for a cigarette and a beer? And they're just like, really? And I was like, no. I would be embarrassed. I'd be embarrassed that I was always the one that was ready to go. So I did that for a lot of years. And that, again, when I was trying to diagnose myself in this program, and I'm hoping that, you know, if you're sitting there thinking whatever you're thinking, it's none of my business. But I had a really difficult time because what I heard in these rooms was the things that I had not yet happened. And what I forgot to listen for was the emotions. And I know that at that point in my drinking, I was trying very desperately to stop drinking or try to control it. And I know today that if I'm trying to control it, I'm not enjoying it. And if I'm enjoying it, it's out of control. And I didn't learn that until I got into this book and I had a competent sponsor that kind of took me through the steps. But at the time, I was thinking that there was no problem with this behavior because I was successful. I graduated cum laude from college, and that was with a starting GPA of 196 after like 60 credit hours. And I was like, yes, I am someone to be reckoned with. And, you know, the funny thing about your college transcripts is I thought that it was like your credit score. After 7 years, if you lay low, it goes away. And that's not the case. I have six different colleges. Every time I want to do something that involves them, I spend like $30 to $40 to get those damn transcripts all together in one place because they never go away. Never, never, never. So that was unpleasant. So where was I? Pop quiz. Where was I? What part are we on? Have I gotten sober yet? No. All right. I'm close, though. Super, super close. So I finished college. The kids that I'm nannying for, they're all grown up. You know, there's no reason that I've got to be there anymore. And so I decide that I'm going to move again. You know, this is going to be the final move. I do some research and decide that Beaufort, South Carolina is the place. It's got a military base. It's got an old folks' place. It's artistic. It's on the beach. I don't know anybody. I'm going to be a Catholic teacher, and I'm going to solve all of my problems. And I remember very specifically thinking, I've got to stay in the church. I have got to stay in the church, because if I don't, I know what's going to happen. And I don't want that to happen. And you guys know what's going to happen for whatever you did to stop drinking or to try and curtail your drinking. If you did, you know that's it's a time-consuming job. And so what I did was to move there and immediately went straight to the parish, and I was like, my name is Beth, and I am here, and I want you to put eyes on me so that now we are accountable, and I am not going to be doing any drugs, I'm not going to be drinking, I'm not going to be behaving, I'm not going to be embezzling anything, none of that, because I'm a Catholic school teacher. And I got there in August, and gosh, by October, it was on again, you know, it was just on again. And this time, there was nobody to stop me, you know, there was nobody to stop me. I had my own house. You know, it was just on, and I met this lovely man and knew immediately the first eight-hour date that we had. We went through a couple of bottles of wine, and I thought, he is the man for me. This is it, you know? And things progressed really quickly. He wound up developing a pretty significant cocaine habit that, you know, he would hallucinate a lot and call the police on himself, and they would show up. And I remember, you know, because I was right next to him. There wasn't anything that he was doing that I wasn't doing. And it was on this island, so we wouldn't drink and drive. Like, we would stockpile. We would stockpile for, like the apocalypse was going to happen, and you had to be ready on this. And we would drive his golf cart around, and it just didn't feel like it was drunk driving. It just felt like this very posh area that we were in. So I remember at one point, he would hallucinate that people were breaking into his house, and you know, the book tells me in the doctor's opinion that we drink for the effect, and although I know it's injurious, I can't differentiate the true from the false. And my brilliant solution to people breaking into his house fictitiously, you know, was to get bungee cords. And he was on like this, I don't know, 14 feet because it was flood plain. And so I put bungee cords around the locks, and I'm like, I have kept us safe. You're like, look at this. And I was showing people, and I'm like, look what I have done. I am going to keep us safe from the marauders. And it took a couple of times for me to figure out what was going on. And, you know, when I finally did, he wound up in a rehab in Statesboro, and that saved both of our lives. It definitely saved mine. And, you know, at the time, trying to figure out what to do with this man who I just loved desperately, who was in a horrible condition, you know, there were children involved, and I wanted to mitigate the consequences. You know, I didn't want the things that were about to happen and couldn't stop them. So I'm talking to this woman who is a judge. She's a judge. She's a drug court judge in Beaufort, South Carolina, or was at the time. And she was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I would call her and I'd be like, Carol, he's about to lose his house and they're going to take his children and blah, 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 blah. And I truly felt like that I was such a good person that she would be like, well, I will take care of that for you, Beth. And certainly your love for this man is going to save you both. And she would just be like, aren't you glad you're not the judge that has to decide that crap? And I would be like, wow, that's not helpful, you know? And so, you know, what she would do is say, well, tell me about your drinking. And so we would go to the huddle house, and I would lie to her. And what I would say would be, like, I halved my drinking and then double halved it, and then I didn't cop to any of the other stuff that I was doing. I was like, no, that's all him, you know? And, you know, she would just kind of nod and smile. And I remember once, like, and I thought, like, I've got to convince this woman, because if I convince this woman, then I'm not an alcoholic, you know, because my life is all about not being an alcoholic. I spent a lot of years not being an alcoholic. And I remember looking at her one day and telling her very earnestly, I was like, I don't drink because I need to. She's like, you know, leans in a little bit, really, Beth, really, what do you drink for? I was like, I drink for the effect. And she's just like, really? And, you know, it wasn't until a couple of months later when we were reading in the doctor's opinion, that's exactly what Dr. Silkworth says. And I just thought, oh, my God, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And Carol knew it before I did. But she didn't say anything. She let me figure that out on my own. And what, you know, the way I figured it out was from the time that that man went to rehab until the time that I picked up the current reigning white chip that I have was 6 months. And it was 6 months of pure hell. It was 6 months where I didn't have the solution that I had had all of my life, and I didn't have any other skill set. So I would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and my mind would be racing, and I wasn't even, I mean, my eyes weren't even open yet, and I was exhausted, like I had lived an entire year. And that's a god-awful place to be without being able to drink or use like I needed to. And I went to Al-Anon, and I thought for sure that, like, I would, you know, be this, because I'm still all about me and wanting to levitate right out of the pew. I'm thinking that I'm going to be the best Al-Anon there is, and I would check his meeting attendance, and I would, you know, gauge his sobriety. And when he got out of rehab, he started to get better, and that made me really angry. I was very angry about that, and I thought, well, if he thinks he's going to get sober without me, that's not going to happen. So I picked up a white chip. I picked up a white chip out of spite and malice on December 2nd. Not because I wanted to stay sober, but because I didn't want him to get better and leave me. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I was reading with a sponsee tonight that in the doctor's opinion, it says, you know, Dr. Silkworth says something like, you know, we hope that if you come to scoff, it's okay. Stay to pray. You know, and I definitely was one that came to scoff. I was not here with you people because you people had problems. And I would listen to your problems and think, well, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. That's not me. And I was without a solution. And so what I got was a sponsor. You know, I got this woman, this drug court judge, and there was immediate accountability. If you don't have a sponsor yet, I imagine, you know, it's you need to get one. They're fun. They're a ton of fun because they say these cryptic things to you, you know. And my sponsor, I would have to go to her house every Sunday night, and I would sit at the end of her bed, and we would read from the big book in the 12 and 12, because she would say things to me like, you know, it's not the world according to Carol, it's not the world according to Beth, this is the solution, this is where the solution is, every problem that you have can be solved through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it can be found in this book. And I felt that was a little bit extreme. I mean, truthfully, I felt like she was a little bit off of her rocker, and you know, what I really thought was that her husband it just needed to take care of her a little bit more because she was a little uptight, you know? And, God, we're not going to show that. We're not going to let her listen to that. But, so, you know, and here's this woman who knows. I mean, she knows. She's been sober. She's been through the steps. And she's, you know, she's very pregnant. And I would sit at the end of her bed, and she would make me read out loud in the big book, and I was so embarrassed about that. And so I would get my teacher voice out, and I'd give it, like, inflection. And, you know, I would be reading with inflection from the big book, and then she'd stop me every once in a while, and she'd prattle on about something in her own life, you know. And what she was doing was trying to help me identify myself, because if I can't identify myself as an alcoholic in these books, then this isn't going to work for me. And I needed something to work for me, because I tried everything that I knew. And I thought, for sure, if I can't get sober in the Catholic Church, then I'm screwed. And that's what happened. You know, I remember thinking one day when everything was just about to fall apart, and I was standing at the sink and just gotten through a huge binge. And I remember thinking, this has got to stop. I'd overdosed that New Year's Eve, gone down, and thank God I didn't hit my face. I hit my hand instead, and I had blood everywhere. And, you know, this man's children saw me like that, dragged me in through the door, put me to bed, and that's what they were seeing. And I remember thinking, I just need to give my life to Jesus. And that sounded so hollow, because I had. You know, that was the last thing that I knew how to do, and I'd already done that, and it wasn't working. And so what Carol would do didn't seem to be, I mean, it didn't make any sense. Me sitting at the end of her bed reading from this book while she talks about her experience made no sense. But she's a drug court judge, and at this point I'm teaching her child in my class. So if I mess up, she's going to get me fired. And that's what's keeping me sober. And that works, you know? I mean, that works. There was still no honest desire to stay sober. I did what she said out of fear of drinking again. And she was a sponsor that would tell me if I wasn't sure that I was an alcoholic or not, here's $20, go on out and try it. And I was terrified. I was terrified that she was going to make me do that. And I didn't want to because I didn't ever want to drink again. But I wasn't sure of what would happen. And, you know, she showed me. She showed me through service to others. She showed me through her own life and her own example what it meant to be a sober and happy member of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was something that I never thought would be synonymous, you know, sober and happy and useful. I mean, those were things who wants that? That sounds very boring. I'd rather die at 29 so that I don't have any of the consequences of my behavior catching up to me. And so I did my step work with her, and, you know, we went through the first, second, third. I did a fourth step that I kind of made up, the four-column inventory, and what it affected I didn't understand, so I was just like, well, I'm just going to make it up. And I was embarrassed. I didn't know how to ask for help, so, you know, I did as thorough a job as I could, and did the best I could and sat down with her, and we got all that stuff out and we burned it, and that was great and it felt good. And I immediately went home and was ugly to my roommate, and I thought, well, that didn't have any effect at all. And started to do my 9-step amends, and that was truly where things started to change for me. I had a lot of financial amends to make, places that I had embezzled from, because I'd embezzled from every job that I had ever had, and I had to do a lot of damage control, of you know, making restitution. And some of the places I could find, some of them I didn't. So I would periodically make the maximum amount allowable to New York, and I would give to battered women's shelters. And there was one amends that I had to make where we had calculated that I owed this man about $5,000, and I really felt like that was like small potatoes to, you know, some of the people that had embezzled millions or whatever. And like, I was feeling pretty cocky about it. I'm just going to go in, give this guy a check, and it's all going to be great. And she looked at me and she's like, well, that's a felony. And I was like, it just finally hit me. You know, as I was doing these amends, it finally hit me that my behavior had an effect on other people. And, you know, this man that I had taken money from, he had since gotten remarried and had twin children that had problems. They had developmental delays, and that was money that was rightfully theirs. And I had a real hard choice to make. I sold my house and was given a windfall. It was a true gift from God. It wasn't anything that I did. And I was able to make the rest of my financial amends, and that was the one that was left. And I was getting ready to come up here, and my sponsor was like, well, you know, make it or not. You know, it's your choice. Because ultimately, it's between me and God. It's not between what she tells me to do. I've got to make a connection with the God of my understanding in order for him to solve my alcohol problem. And so I remember thinking, well, I could go up to Atlanta and marry that lovely man, and we don't ever have to worry about this, and I'm going to leave it in the past and not think about it anymore. But I knew that what would happen was that I would get drunk again, and I didn't want to do that. So for a couple of weeks before that check hit escrow, I did a lot of praying, and I did a lot of honest soul searching, and I decided that if I needed to go to jail for this amends, that I was cool with that. I knew the clerk of court, and she promised to spring me the next morning, and I had enough money for bail, and, you know, I didn't start my job until August, so if I needed to stay for like a month or so, I would do that because I didn't want to get drunk. And I went and made that amends to this man, and I gave him a cashier's check, and, like, I know that there's a formula that you're supposed to follow. You know, you're supposed to say that I was wrong. What I did was wrong. Here are the ways that I harmed you. What can I do to make restitution? And I just bawled. I sat in front of that man and I started to cry, and I told him that I was an alcoholic and that I had stolen from him. And if he wanted to call the police, that was fine. And he's just like, you know, he was just, because nobody had ever done that before to him. And I'm sure he had, you know, lost control or prevention or whatever. But, you know, here's someone who's desperately trying to stay alive at this point in front of him with a cashier's check. And he took it and he's like, thanks. And that was big. And I'd love to say that that kept me sober and happy. It did keep me sober, but I wasn't happy because when I came to Atlanta, I didn't work with a sponsor. And what happened was that I got sick really fast. And this time I'd already done all of this work. You know, I'd done my 9-step amends to the best of my ability, and I'd been as honest as I could on that first that first fourth step. And when I got here, I got a sponsor that was like, well, you can call me whenever you feel like it. And I was like, I really don't feel like it. You know, I feel like I'm fine. Like, I just made this huge amends. I think I might be graduating. I don't need AA anymore. And it took about probably 2 months before I got real suicidal. And this was really strange because I'm not drinking anymore. I'd had some success. I was about, 18, 20 months sober. And I'm thinking that if I touch the tile in my kitchen, I'm going to drink Drano. And that's when I first began to understand what powerlessness was. I think up until that point, I knew my life was unmanageable, but powerlessness was something completely different. And when I couldn't control the way that I thought in sobriety without a program, that was scary enough for me to take the first step unreservedly. And what I found was a woman who took me through the steps in a radically different way. And what she had me do was to get real accountable. I had to go to a meeting every single day. I had to call her every single day at a certain time. I had to go early. I had to thank the speaker. I had to read in my big book, and I was just like, I've been sober. Have I met you? I'm sober. And she's like, yeah, well, what you're doing isn't working, so maybe you might want to try this. And I did. And I went back through the steps, and there had been some things that I kept off my first fourth step that I was able to really get out. And what happened was just a radically different idea about what life can be like. I went through the rest of them with this woman and finished up all of my ninth step amends. And, you know, what I can tell you about sobriety that way and the way that it's the way that it was given to me, because it was through watching someone in front of me, was that my life is radically different. You know, I just there's peace. You know, there was never peace in my life. There was never any sort of happiness. You know, I would spend days eulogizing my parents because I felt like anything that would be that significant in my life would really let me drink the way I wanted to. I needed significant disasters to be able to let go like I needed to let go of. And I don't feel like that anymore. I don't think like that anymore. There was a time when I thought that I was possessed because of what was going on in my mind. I definitely don't feel like that anymore. And I think that it took me about 4 years to have my first sponsee, and that's where it happens. You know, when I get to get out of myself and be a part of somebody else's life and watch their lives change, it reinforces what I know, which is that these steps work. I watched a woman who had lost most of her teeth. I sat with her while she had the rest of them pulled, and I don't recommend that. It was really gross, but the fact that what I was given here, what that first sponsor gave to me, what that second sponsor, the third sponsor I had gave to me, and what my current sponsor gave to me now is humanity. I felt like I was living like sort of like a feral animal when I was out there. You know, there was just, man, it was just ugly. I mean, preaching to the choir, right? It was just ugly. And it's not like that today. Obviously, I just said that. But one of the things that I do for the women that I sponsor and women in general, I think, was that it was important to me to feel like I was part of society, like I wasn't a throwaway person. And one of the things that I noticed is, and you know, I've gone through periods of like super ridiculous service work. There was a time that I was, and it's good. I mean, God uses all of that stuff. But there's a time I was working with the nuns, Mother Teresa's nuns, and I was spending the night at the Missionaries of Charity home, like caring for these women that have, they're dying of AIDS. And I was, you know, super spiritual, and I'm just all about me again. And you know, in the mornings I would bestow them with eggs and coffee, and they were ungrateful. They didn't like my coffee. And I was just like, who are you to not like my coffee, my spiritually fit coffee? But what I noticed was that, you know, for me it was so important to feel like a human being again and to differentiate between what I had done and who I was. When I stopped drinking and using, I stopped a lot of the behaviors that were felonious. And would get me into a lot of trouble. But what I didn't have was that idea that there was a, you know, in step two where it talks about that loving God, and I needed to build a relationship with someone that was merciful, loving, had a sense of humor, and someone that I could really work for, because that's ultimately what happens when I got sober, was that I needed to find new management. And so, you know, realizing that the only thing that I can do is with my own hands, and that's generally very small and inconsequential, I decided that it would be a good idea to get handkerchiefs. You know, for a dollar, you can go to I don't know, wherever, and get little linen handkerchiefs. And what a difference that can make in somebody's life. You know, when we reach out, when I reach out and give something fine to someone that maybe doesn't feel so fine, what I learn is that it's not about you loving me until I can love myself. It's about me loving other people until I can learn that I can love myself, which is always backwards. So step three I took and didn't really think too much about it. I felt real weird. I was, you know, sitting on my knees, and I didn't understand what giving my life and my will over to the care of God as I understood him. I didn't understand that. Although I know today that above all else, whatever happens in life, whether it's, you know, whatever is in store for me, it matters less to me what it looks like, as long as it's in harmony with the God that I serve today. And, you know, in terms of how it looks, I still have to do a bi-yearly four-step on somebody. It's usually my assistant, because I'm still not that great about working with other people. But I know that there are tools, you know, and the tools that I found here continually point back to my poor behavior or ways that I can change the way that I'm behaving in order to not have to drink again. So, you know, and then I'll do the amends process from that. This year has really been about identifying my character defects, 6 and 7, and looking really honestly about the stuff that still plagues me. And, you know, realizing that it's going to go back to 2. I've got to be okay with a God that I love and that loves me to remove that stuff. You know, 10, I did for a long time, I did a nightly inventory, and I used that for a while, and I could start to see patterns of behavior. And that was important, because I always felt like life had been perpetrated on me. I didn't know that there was some way that I could act differently, and really having that concretely in front of you was essential. My sponsor has me sit down. I had to do a timer for step 11, which is, you know, sought through prayer and meditation, because I'm not someone that likes to sit still. And so she, you know, and that's a spiritual exercise, you know, calling a sponsor and actually soliciting her advice and then taking it is huge. So I do that, and now it's not so hard. And I do, you know, an AA reading, and I do some other readings, and you know, I forget it right when I leave the door to go out into the world. But I remember, you know, when things start to go south in my life, I remember what I'm supposed to do. And usually that looks like getting on my knees in some gross bathroom, because I'm a germaphobe, and I've got like all sorts of, you know, the little hand sanitizer, and I'll put down some little, you know, square of toilet paper, and I'll get down and I'll be like, oh God, you got to take this, because I just can't. And then 12, you know, it's working with other people, and it's not always sponsorship, although I sponsor women, and truly I am sober off of their backs, because I look at them and I look at the way that God works in their lives, and I think, well, they're not as smart as I am. I can have that too, you know? And that's important. And, you know, I think that it's not always that for 6 months I wiped down the counters at 8111. And I felt like I was a part of that clubhouse because that was my counter. If that's my counter, then I get to stay there. And if I get to stay there, then this might work for me. And, you know, for someone that's never felt like they were a part of and has been tremendously uncomfortable in my own skin, to have the words to be able to say that, to have the ability to stand in front of people I don't know and talk about some pretty egregious things, and know that there's hope at the end of it. You know, whatever the specifics are secondary to the fact that this works. It works for people that don't believe in it. I just have to keep coming back. I just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And, you know, life is amazing. I think that's all I've got. I think that's it. So thank you. All right.